work with groups, doing a lot of community radio and low power radio and producers to help them do planning. It's grant writing is part of that, but it's not only not the whole thing. It usually is where does it fit in financial planning with stations, what are the real resources that are available to stations and producers for the kind of work that they're doing now.
Would you close that door, please?
I'm going to touch on a whole bunch of things real quickly because I think I'm the only one who's really talking about some of this stuff. And if this is too distracting, I will move to a different part of the room. But most of the information that I'm going to talk about is appropriate for both independent producers, individuals who are working on projects, and stations or producers based in stations or people involved in other station work. It's primarily focused on programming, but there are other things that can be done. And certainly, if you have specific needs or questions, we can talk about that later or as part of the question period. And if you want some real individual conversation, just grab me and I'll be happy to sit down and talk to you about anything that's real individual or specific to what you're trying to do in your own station. I don't usually talk about rules, but there's really four rules for any kind of fundraising that you're doing. I don't care what it is. If it's building a coalition, if it's going to ask for money from a donor, if it's putting a proposal together, whatever it is. And there's really only one rule, and the rest is sort of variations on it. But the most important thing is you have to ask for the money. You won't get it if you don't ask for it. And don't think that's a small thing, because sometimes it's hard to ask. Sometimes even when you're writing a proposal, you forget that even in writing, you have to ask. So it's very important to keep in mind that whatever you do, you have to make sure you ask for whatever you're looking for. Ask for that money. Is that a question?
No, I'm sorry. Okay. I can get this guy in.
So that's, if you don't remember anything else, remember, you've got to ask for what you want. The second thing, which goes along with it, and really is the key to how successful you're going to be once you actually ask, is building personal relationships. And that means with individuals who might be supportive, with colleagues who you may be asking to join you, with funders, with people from staffs of organizations, etc. And I can't emphasize how important this is, because you could be brilliant writing down grants. You could be brilliant putting together sample tapes, all of that kind of stuff. You could have a fabulous track record. If they don't know who you are, or if they've never met you, and they can't picture you in some fashion, you're going to be less likely to be successful than if they do know who you are. And if you get to know them, they're going to get to know you. That's what you want. You want them to know who you are, so that when your name comes across somebody's desk or in a letter or whatever it is, they're going to say, oh, I remember meeting that person. And that personal connection has a lot to do with whether they're going to be likely to give you money than someone that is a stranger that they don't know. So as much as possible, put yourself in a position to meet the people that you're dealing with, that you're going to be asking to, that you may be wanting to work with on some level. Get to meet them personally as much as you can, even if it's just a handshake at a meeting or something like that. So you could say to them, so they'll remember that they saw you with your name tag on. Relationships. And again, keep in mind the relationship, it's partially for you to know them and to get to know them. Why don't you move that chair so you don't have to, yeah. So that you know what it is that they really want, but a lot of it is so they know who you are. This is, once they know who you are, it becomes much easier to get money. The third thing is don't be afraid, really. I know it's kind of can make you really nervous. Don't be afraid. For many of the people that you're going to be dealing with, it's their job to give away money. That's what they get paid to do. They're expecting you to ask them for money. They're waiting for you to ask them for money. Don't be afraid to ask them. Because what's the worst thing that's going to happen? What's the very worst thing that can happen? Anybody?
They'll say no.
So they said no. And then you know what you do? That's the fourth rule. You ask them again. Ask them again. Always go back. Because you don't know when a no is going to turn into a yes. And there's many reasons why people say no, and it doesn't always mean they don't want to give you the money. Sometimes they can't give you the money. Sometimes they just met you, but the one that they've been working with for 6 months is the one that they have to give the money to first, or next in line. Sometimes their circumstances just change, and they're ready to give you the money now. So don't take no for an answer.
Might even be new people there or something.
Whatever, could be. So that, go back and ask again. So start by asking, and then when you get through all of that, ask again. Maybe you don't ask them again the next day, but always keep them, once you know who they are, you always have a chance that they're going to want to support you. This goes for individuals, it goes for foundations, all of that. Unless it's a foundation that comes and says, you know, we really have changed our funding priorities and we're only doing, you know, like animal preservation in Africa. That still doesn't mean they may not fund you to do something. But just then go back and keep asking. So just keep in mind, you know, you can always turn a no into a yes. And if you don't bother asking, it's always going to be no. Or you'll never even know. So, given that context, the things I'm going to say are more of some of the resources, and some of these are kind of, might be sort of familiar. I'm going to just sort of give you a little bit of landscape of where people are getting money for stations and productions. And there's a couple of case studies or models that I'm going to talk about in more depth that I think are actually really good and flexible. I'm going to start with the stuff that's the least likely to get you money, and that's grants. And the least likely to get you money are national grants. Don't go to the Ford Foundation. They're not going to give you any money. It's highly unlikely that you can get, in your position, funding from a prominent national foundation for any of the work you do. Mostly because they're interested in big projects, national projects, et cetera, and they're looking for really big things, and you need a real track record for that. If you have a track record and you think you're ready for that, it's another story. But if you're working primarily on a local level, they're just not going to be interested, and you don't have to worry about asking them. You can check out what they're funding, and I'll give you some of that information in a minute, but don't go to the, you know, when you do a search on foundation stuff or anything like that and it says media, don't waste your time with a lot of that because it's not likely that you're going to get it. And you need a real presence to kind of even be able to talk to those folks about what you might be doing. However, you have much better opportunity to get grant funding from local and state sources. And that's because you're in a much better position to be able to know them and for them to get to know you. You're in a much better position that their priorities are going to be local, and you are local.
No,
maybe you want to move that chair like over here so you're not sitting like right in front of the people behind you. Excellent. It's also more likely that local funding will be for smaller amounts and things that are a little bit more manageable for the kinds of things that you might be interested in. And those sources might be a little bit harder to dig up, but they will be much closer in terms of being connected. Christine was just telling me at lunch about some money that she got from basically a local family foundation. That, you know, one of the family members has been listening to FFS, and they had made a grant, you know, out of the family foundation. They wrote a pretty sizable check, and one of the family members got more interested, came back to her, and said, "We think we want to give you more money," and she invited them here, and so it looks like they're going to get a bigger check. And that's the kind of thing, it's purely local, you probably won't find it in anything, but the connection is a personal one. And it's one that they feel very, you know, this individual feels really related to the station, and they feel like it's something, you know, it's like their station. So that's the kind of thing, you can't really plan on it, but you always want to be looking out for that kind of thing because it can be extremely fruitful. But it's local. And there are also areas in terms of state funding, particularly state arts and humanities councils. Now, at one point, most of the state's arts and humanities councils around the United States loved radio. They love it because it's inexpensive. It hits their constituency that they have to serve is adult out of school population. That's radio does beautifully. So they always really like radio projects. And because local radio projects are relatively affordable, you can go in with a proposal that's within their guidelines and it'll be significant to you as a producer or the station. And it's within their own guidelines because most of them don't have a lot of money. State's Arts and Humanities Council also often will fund individual producers. So you don't have to even be incorporated. They also, of course, will fund stations and they'll fund producers working through stations and all those things. But it's much easier to get money from them because their job is to keep the money in the state to do this. Now, within the last 5 years, given a lot of the economic ups and downs, many states have had their arts and humanities funding cut, but they haven't eliminated it. And radio still remains one of the most cost-effective means for them to meet their mission. So absolutely get on their mailing list, go to their websites, no matter where you live, and look at what they're doing in radio. And start applying for those monies. And I think you'll find that in many instances, you'll get it. They don't have a lot of radio competition. Here in New York, they have very, very little radio proposals even going into the applications. You know, and they haven't done a lot of outreach on it, but you know, video is very sexy and has a high profile, and radio is like invisible. So I feel like we ought to just inundate them with radio proposals, and a whole lot of them are going to get funded. And again, it can be station funding or individual funding based on the guidelines and what they're looking for. Also, there are community funds. Even many small cities and medium-sized cities have community funds. What these are they're not strictly foundations, so they operate primarily like foundations. Many wealthy individuals don't want to set up their own foundations. It's expensive, you know, they have overhead, blah, blah, blah. But there are rules that allow them to take a sizable amount of money and give it to an entity whose job it is to hand it out. And this, in many places, it's community funds. And the community foundations basically aggregate funding from many individuals for philanthropic uses. This is also money that has to be spent locally. They can't spend it anywhere else. And even a lot of small cities have community foundations. And again, they'll have guidelines, et cetera. But they have to spend the money where you are. And if you go in there, get to meet the people. When you set up meetings with formals, like foundation staff people or something, you don't have to go in and you know, worry about asking them for money. Go in and say, we just want to introduce ourselves. We want you to know who we are. And that will naturally turn to, you know, what you're doing, and then they will say, naturally, here's what we're interested in, and they go, oh, we're working on that. But you don't think that you have to go in there right away and that you're even going to ask for money, because you don't. Just say, we really just want you to know who we are, what we're doing. Take your propaganda, put them on the mailing list. This is what I mean when I say let them get to know who you are. And then when it's time to really ask them for the money, it becomes much easier. Because you yourself also know who you're dealing with. And you say, oh, that guy, you know, he's really an idiot. All we have to do is tell him this. And they'll write the check. You might say, well, you know, this one, you know, we have to do a little more work. Or if we have to do this and that, maybe we don't quite meet the criteria. But we'll still make sure they know who we are because we can change tomorrow. So those are all kind of local sources of funding. Some of them are private funding. There also will be private foundations in many places. Many places don't have them, but a lot of places do have private foundations. Many of the private foundations will be based on family criteria. Those are harder to crack. Because unless you've got a family member who just falls in love with your radio programming or your radio station, they're probably giving it to United Way or, you know, some other thing that the family's interested in. But, you know, take a look. You can do the research. You can find out who's in your region. Some of it's also regional. And
how can we do that kind of research?
I'll get to that in a minute. It's not hard. A lot of it's online. And there's a couple places. Do you want me to tell you? I mean, I can tell you the information now. It's all
easier. I need her drop.
It's okay. So the private foundations usually are quirkier than the public funds. Like community funds have to be sort of responsive to the community. State agencies absolutely have to be responsive to the state. Private foundations, you know, it's kind of up for grabs. If you can, you know, but do your homework and you may find some that actually are approachable. But mostly, if you go to some social events in your community, you meet, wind up meeting these people, that's really what you have to do. One way also to do research is to go to like-minded groups and look at their donor lists. And you don't have to ask them, like, who's on your mailing list. You go to an event, and a lot of times they'll just list their sponsors. Get those lists and look at the sponsors. And you can see, oh, there's so-and-so. He's on our subscriber list to the station. You know, that kind of thing. And that's like, you know, the art museum, the symphony, the local art gallery, the local theater group. All of those people usually have publications where they list the people who give them donations. So you can start there for individual things. And sometimes it will also list local foundations and stuff like that. So you don't even have to look very far to get that information. It's not secret, and you don't have to think that it's like all like people hiding it. It's not. It's really out there in pretty easy ways to get. I'll mention the websites at the end because they're more than just for funders. There are a couple sources of federal funding that I'm going to mention. One is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. It's a fund that's available to independent producers as well as stations. They have particular criteria, and they've actually changed the criteria lately. They used to only fund national stuff. You know, if you weren't Garrison Keillor or the Car Guys, you were going to have a hard time getting money. But now they're funding regional things. If you're engaged in a regional project, they definitely will consider a proposal. And they're also beginning to fund station things, individual station program projects. This is brand new. They do have criteria. It's probably useful to do a little homework and find out, talk to some of the people who are involved with who know CPB or can talk to CPB about this in terms of whether or not what you are doing would actually fit. But if it fits, go for it. They shouldn't be let off the hook by just being afraid that you're not going to be able to compete with, you know, the Car Guys. Put those applications in. You have to have really good demo tapes. Your audio has to be good. That's what you're competing on. It doesn't matter how well you write. People are going to listen to your stuff when you send it into any radio fund. They're going to listen to it. It really has to sound competitive. That doesn't mean it has to sound slick, but it has to sound good. So keep that in mind. And maybe at one of these conferences, I don't know if they have it here, but maybe next year, they can do a listening session, not just how to do better radio, but how to do competitive, how to do your competitive demo tapes. Not just how to do grants, but how to do competitive demo tapes. So that when they tell you they're only going to listen to 3 minutes, you know which 3 minutes to give them. Because when they say 3 minutes, they don't mean six. They mean three. You better make sure they get the right ones queued up. You better have it queued in the right place for them to hear it. So make sure you do have a good demo tape. You never know when you're going to need it anyway. You may find at one of these parties, you know, you'll find some, you know, person with their family foundation, and they won't know what you do, and you'll say, maybe you'll take a few minutes. I got a 5-minute tape. Don't give them anything more than that because they won't listen. But you never know when you might have use for that. So there's the radio fund. You can get the information about the CPB Radio Fund on their website. But it's not cpb.org. That's the public website. It's called stations.cpb, I think. Stations.cpb.org. Because the public website is sort of like, you know, what they're telling the public. But they have the one that's really for the stations. And the radio fund is part of that. And all of this stuff is also kind of public, and you can get other proposals that have been funded, and you can talk to people on the panels and all that. I mean, there's a whole lot of us that get called in to be on panels because they also need to have a bunch of people that are advising them. I will say that at this moment in time, and it's, I think, just for this grant round, it's very uncertain what they're going to be funding because up until this past year, the CPB radio funds, both station and program funds, were very tightly controlled by this guy, Rick Madden, who was the vice president for radio. And he passed away. And so right now things are up for grabs a little bit at CPB. And I don't know if they're going to have, if they're either going to go into the panel with a strong, we have to remember what Rick wanted kind of thing, which will be bad. Or they'll go in and have kind of no guidelines and sort of let everything kind of come in and it won't be quite as rigid as it has been in the past. But that'll change by next year. So just, you know, some of us that are more kind of plugged into the CPB stuff, you can just keep track. And, you know, NFCB and stuff also keeps track of that stuff. And a lot of the independent producers who are more visible, high profile producers also know, and it's, you can talk to the producers that are engaged in this and find out what's really happening. AIR, the Association for Independence of Radio, the whole organization is independent producers, and they pay close attention to this, and they're all very accessible.
I just have a quick question. Do you know, is there a strong division or a classification called CPB qualified? Is that true?
Not for programming.
Okay.
For
so
stations.
The five employees, 100,000,
no.
That kind of stuff.
The question that you asked about CPB qualified is strictly related to operational money that goes to radio stations for radio station activities. Those criteria are very, what I'm talking about is radio program money. There are no qualifications for that. It has nothing, you don't have to be at a station with any staff. You could be an individual, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they have criteria you have to meet, and they have standards they expect you to meet, and there's reporting requirements, et cetera. But there's nothing like that, that in terms of qualification.
Along that line, are you out of this game if you don't have 501c3?
For CPB, I think you must have a 501c3 to receive money. But it could be a fiscal agent. It could be a station that you pass the money through. You could find a sympathetic, arts organization or something like that. It doesn't have to be radio. It doesn't have to be a radio group. Okay. So CPB radio funds. All of you, if you do really good demo tapes, you can compete for this money. The National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities. These are big-time national funds. They've been cut way, way back from Congress for all kinds of political reasons. They do have radio money. The National Endowment for the Arts is much easier to get money from than the Humanities Endowment. But if you have a project that meets the criteria, go for it. They do give money to individuals. They do give money to stations. They do give money to consortia. They'll give money to any formulation you have. And they also have different levels, some of which are kind of entry-level type funds. Read the criteria. Ask people who have been, who have gotten money from them. Read the proposals. Find out, what are the issues, etc. So you can position yourself and start putting yourself in front of those people for funds.
In Pennsylvania, they started a fast-track program. And we just apply for a grant.
At the state
for
first, level.
Yeah, from state
yeah.
level.
Will you hear when I talked about state state arts and humanities funding? I said that's always really good. Yeah. But that's not the national level.
So it's like three pieces of paper.
Yeah. A lot of the states have real streamlined application forms. I mean, really, when you're talking state level, you're really talking about people that are basically your peers. You absolutely should not be afraid of them. You should actually just feel like they're there to help you. And a lot of times, they really will sit down and walk you through everything you need. Most of them, they really feel like getting the money out into the communities for this stuff is really what makes it worthwhile for them. The national people, again, they're kind of working on sort of a different plane, but you can participate just as well. And they're also not scary. The Humanities Endowment is a little different because with the Humanities Endowment, it is really focused a lot on scholarly participation. It's not humanists, it's humanities scholars. There are some projects you may be working on or that your station may be developing that actually is appropriate. But the Endowment for the Arts is much easier, and their criteria and all of their funding is much more geared to the kind of things that we do, even for documentary and news, than humanities. Humanities is more geared towards larger, more in-depth examinations that are going to have scholars commenting on blah, blah, blah. However, if you're doing something in your local area, say with the local historical society, that's perfect. That's the kind of thing they will do. Or if you're doing something, say, with the local, just for example, I did a project a couple of years ago in Rochester, and we included the Black History Trail and the Women's Suffrage Historical Site. That's perfect for the humanities. That's the kind of thing they like. But again, you have to read their criteria and their guidelines, and you can usually find people who have been engaged in some of this stuff, people we know who work on these proposals and know how to put them together. The humanities ones also are more work because they want all kinds of scholarly stuff, but they get bigger amounts of money.
How much partnering of that type is there with radio stations and, say, the Black Scholarship?
They're not going to come to you. You have to do it in partnership, and they're not going to come to you, so you go to them.
Right, but I mean...
All of it's in partnership. You can't do it by yourself. You have to have partners.
Okay, so...
You can't do it by yourself. You're not a scholar, are you? Do you have a PhD?
It's not dry yet.
Okay. I'm being a little facetious. No, literally, you must do this in partnership with these people. The proposals themselves are geared towards having collaborations among various experts, et cetera, you know, not just scholars, but even in arts. I mean, you know, unless you're doing this under an individual artist program, you're doing this as some kind of a collaboration with an arts organization or with a cultural group or with, you know, a community of artists or you know, whatever it is. Two national sources, I'm just going to mention two national sources which are really only for you to know about because you're not really able to apply, but if you're at a station, these things will come up. The first is the Public Telecommunications Facilities Program, PTFP. It's a program at the Department of Commerce. It's money that only funds equipment. However, it's not for producers, it's really for stations. And it funds things like transmitters and antennas, and it will fund production studios. But if you need a couple of, you know, mini disc recorders and a, you know, digital editing setup, this is not the program for you. And I mentioned it only because people might ask about it, and you need to know that it really has a very narrow criteria for selection, and it must be a station that applies. Yes.
Would that be useful for a low-power FM?
Yes, they will fund low-power FM.
Is this federal?
It's federal. It's from the Federal Department of Commerce. They have a lot of information on their website, but there's a couple of us, and I will put myself in this category, who have written these grants year after year. We can tell you probably everything you need to know at this point in time about whether you should apply. I don't mean should. Whether you can apply competitively. Everyone can, but some people will be more competitive. And also politically, what are the issues? Most of these grants, with the federal grants and also with NEA and NEH, they have different cycles of funding, and obviously you have to fit within their calendar. PTFP is annual, so, you know. But again, as I said, I only mentioned it because you may see it as like a federal source of money if you do a search and it says radio, but that's not really where you're going to.
What's the deadline on that one?
The deadline for PTFP is usually in January or February. This year it was in January. They usually announce the criteria in November or December, and that's when they release the application forms, and the deadline is usually within a 60 or 90 days after that. So it's usually early in the calendar year. Yeah.
Can you say what PTFP stands for again?
It stands for Public Telecommunications Facilities Program. Their website is very good. All their materials are online, including the last 3 years of applications. So you can see who got money for what. They've actually done a very good job.
Do you know that website?
Yeah, it's the website is N, letter N, letter T, letter I, letter A, dot, letter D, letter O, letter C, dot, G-O-V. It's NTIA at the Department of Commerce. It's NTIA, DOC, Department of Commerce, G-O-V.
Is that a www, or does it go right from HD?
I think it goes right to the thing, but if it's www, you can figure that out.
Can you put dollar amounts or parameters or ranges?
For PTFP?
Yeah, for any of these things.
Sure.
Did you get this for BAI, and if so, how much did you get?
I got a PTFP grant for BAI 3 years ago for $85,000. It's a matching grant, so the whole grant proposal was for $170,000.
So we had to put up $80,000.
It's a dollar-to-dollar match on that one. Most of these federal proposals, though not all of them are matching, but they all have different things. Some of them are just grants, some of them are matching. I mean, some of them you have to match a cash, some of them you have to match it in kind. You have to read the directions. PTFP, the smallest grant that I saw that they gave out was $35,000. The biggest grant is close to $1 million. It includes television. and it includes distance learning. Radio is a small part of it, but they have to fund it in every state. It's a little bit of a pork barrel. So you're not really competing against the other people in the United States. You're really just competing in other people in your state who are applying. And that could be the big telecommunications entity at the university. It could be another community radio station down the road, you know, that kind of thing. This is the part where I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of models, and then I'll throw it open to some other stuff. There are two models that I wanted to tell you about because I think both of them are kind of viable, and the first one in particular. One of the groups that I work with a lot is WOMR, which is a community station in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I think they have 2.5 paid staff or something like that. And it's a seasonal station because it's Provincetown. They have a very small population there between September and May, and then June, July, and August, of course, it's, you know, all hell breaks out. So they have to do a lot of their fundraising during the summer in terms of over-the-air fundraising. But there's a lot of issues that they're involved in during the year. I mean, they're on the air the whole time, all year round. And they're very plugged into a lot of the groups that are working on issues on the Cape, you know, all year round. They came up with an idea for a program that they wanted to do called the Environmental Roundtable. The Cape ecology is very fragile. They're facing a lot of issues relating to development, relating to economics, you know, the decline of fishing, the rise of tourism, expanding population, et cetera. I mean, these are things that are familiar to many of us. Plus, the ecosystem there, you know, they don't have a lot of water because of their geology, all of those kinds of things. And the environment is something that many of their volunteers and the residents in the area are really involved in. So they came up with this idea of doing the Environmental Roundtable. A weekly program focusing on environmental affairs, including like a little mini doc, and then focuses on specific issues, you know, different ones with call-in segment. I mean, they were really trying to do this participatory. And what they did was they got together 25 environmental groups on the Cape, people involved in development, people involved in issues relating to the ecostructure. They included the National Seashore, which is there. They included many of the people that are dealing with issues relating to the economy and depletion of the resources in the ocean, since that's also a big movement there. And the first thing they did was they said, we want to put together this round table and everybody has to pony up some money. So each group put in a couple $100s. So they had a pool of money right from the start. And they were able to start thinking about what the program would look like, etc. And with that organization in place, and it wasn't like you had to, it was sort of a coalition, but, you know, participatory, and, you know, people could leave or stay in, but it also meant that they could attract more people, and part of joining included a financial commitment, a modest one, but a financial commitment, so they actually had some money to work with. Then they actually found that in Massachusetts there were a couple of foundations, private foundations, that were really funding issues in the environment. That was their thing. And they were looking at New England environmental issues, and they were ready-made for it. They put in a proposal to a couple of these foundations from the roundtable. They already had a constituency of 25 groups. They already had a commitment to show that these groups really wanted this program on the air, and they had money in place. And they were able to use that to match it, you know, like 100 times over. And so they were able to get a modest grant, but perfect for what they needed, to actually pay a producer, which is really what they needed, not on staff of WOMR, but really someone who was part-time, who was the producer for this program, to get it launched. Now, they were lucky because they were able to find some money from a foundation to fund it, but it launched a lot of things. And this foundation went to a couple of other foundations and said, we love this project, and it generated more money and support. Meanwhile, it was giving support directly to the environmental groups, and they were doing like town meetings on the air. It was going out directly to the population living on the Cape involved in this issue. I thought it was a wonderful strategy. Everybody loved it. Everybody benefited. And the station had some money to cover its operations. A producer got some funding, and all of these groups had their voice on the air in a way that wasn't just, you know, the environmental hour kind of thing. So that really was a partnership that had a lot of elements to it. But I think you could put things like that together in a similar way that could also be very, very lucrative and attract support, particularly from some of these local groups. You know, maybe there's even a local organization that has some money to do it. But if everybody chips in a little bit, you know, you can, it gives you something to start.
Was that a local show once a week, an hour?
Yeah, it was a local show once a week. But I actually think they were working with, I don't know if they were working with WERU, but they were working with several other stations along the Massachusetts coast, because there's also a major initiative around Gloucester, which is, you know, north of Boston, on many of the same issues, and I think they were working in partnership with them as well, because it wasn't just their, it was their coast, but it was also the whole New England region. The second model is one that I'm going to talk about, because I think it is one that's really accessible to you, and it's a little different from the Environmental Roundtable, but it's also really good. And that's Sound Partners. I don't know if any of you here know about this. Sound Partners is actually a grant program. It's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Anybody know what Robert Wood Johnson funds? Anybody here?
Health-related.
They fund health-related stuff. They got convinced by Mark Sachs and a few other people that radio was a really cost-effective way for them to fund some of their mission-oriented programs. And they had been funding, you know, like NPR to underwrite, you know, a health story on Morning Edition. They were extremely unsatisfied with all of this. They really didn't like it. It was expensive. They didn't feel that it had any impact. They wanted to do something else. And so what they did was set up a really different kind of model, which is a little bit like the roundtable model. It's based on local partnerships. They set aside a couple $1 million. They didn't want to deal with a lot of small grants. They gave their couple $1 million to the Benton Foundation. The Benton Foundation was prepared to give away small grants. They set up a program that gives away grants between $15,000 and $35,000 at a time. The grants go to the radio stations. The radio stations have to go in to Benton in partnership with one or more local health organization to put together a community-based series of programs. These can be on the air and off the air, and I can give you a couple of examples. The stations have almost all used the money to hire a local producer or an executive producer to help actually pull the thing together. These are small grants. Almost all the money has gone to community stations, almost all of it. The stations have to work closely with their health partnership group. And Robert Wood Johnson does have some criteria. You just can't go in there for anything. They have several priorities for funding that they are funding. But they're fairly general, and some of them are ones that you're probably already engaged in, or that your stations might be engaged in, or that you might be interested in. And Robert Wood Johnson also provides some technical assistance on some of this, but that's not the important part. The important part is it's based on the station having the money, so it's not going to a health group to say, go to a station and talk to them about doing a PSA campaign. It goes to the station, which then can think about what's appropriate to do, what to appropriate on air and off air, in partnership with the group that they're working with.
So do they fund any alternative programs?
Or like what?
Well, alternative health, complementary health, as opposed to conventional health.
Well, they're not funding anything about health delivery. They're funding things like smoking and alcohol abuse prevention. They're funding things like youth. They're funding end-of-life issues, things like that. I don't think they have any... I mean, I think if you go in a partnership with a group that's doing something that's alternative, I think they'd be happy to consider it. But it has to meet their criteria for what they're doing.
What about something like AIDS or one of the other...
You have to look at their criteria.
Okay.
I mean, I can't tell... I'm telling you, they have some, and you have to fit their criteria, but whatever they are.
Yeah.
They seem to be extremely open-minded about that, and they've been giving this money now for a couple of years to community stations in partnership with these local groups, and they are so happy about the results because they're having real impact on the ground. And they are trying to convince other funders to follow this model for radio funding and for partnership support. And even though it is money that's available in this particular area, again, it's a kind of model. You might be able to use that kind of model in, you know, to form a partnership with a local group on something you're working with and go to your community foundation and say, we would like to do this. And here's the Robert Johnson Foundation that has already decided they're going to double the money because they like the impact so much and how much it's gotten their message out in a way that's been very meaningful. And the local health-related organizations also are very happy about it because they're the ones that are forming the content message. The radio station is the one that's figuring out how to make a good radio. Some of it has been talk shows. Some of it has been sort of PSAs. Some of it has been like on-the-air roundtables. A lot of it has been in conjunction with printed material that gets distributed in the community, public forums. One of the groups that was working on child health, I can't remember what it was. I think it was in Michigan. Michigan State has one of these programs where they will enroll eligible children for free health insurance. And they weren't getting enough enrollees in some of these small areas. So the radio station, in conjunction with you know, the local group that was working on that, put together an over-the-year campaign that was based on a really popular, they had their own kind of local car guys. And these guys did like this public awareness campaign. And they teamed it up with a kind of a print campaign where they actually went around. Every 7-Eleven in that area had copies of this this little brochure, How to Sign Your Kid Up, you know, for free health care. So it had a huge impact on the community. That's the kind of thing that the stations were doing in partnership. And it was tremendously successful, and the money was great. But it also had a greater purpose than just a sort of self-expression thing. It was a real, you know, these are real community services. So those kinds of partnerships are ones that I think are beginning to be much more successful and attractive for program funding, and force you as a producer and you as a station to work with other people in your community. You can't just do it in your editing booth. And the stations have found it's tremendously reinforcing to them because they get all of this reinforcement back from the community. It brings them membership, it brings them listenership, and they're seen as a real strong you know, partner in the community, a real community station, you know, that they have a real role as a community station. And the community groups that they're working with couldn't ask for anyone that could give them broader exposure. And I'm saying all of this in a roundabout way to say there's ways you can get money like that if you're really trying to think creatively about what it is you want to say and how to do it. Who do you need to have it? Who do you need to be in partnership with? And for Robert Wood Johnson, they've turned this into a very high-profile program, and they are trying to work with other big funders to put aside money to do some of the same things because they're fed up with, you know, underwriting and NPR. They just got disgusted with it.
How did they pick the smaller organization, nonprofit? I think the names of some person, family names.
Benton.
The Benton Foundation?
How did they get connected with the, who picked who? Or how did they?
Robert Wood Johnson?
Yeah.
Benton is a kind of unusual foundation. It's not, it doesn't like give out its own grants really. It's really set up to do sort of re-granting and do
small. Like Hyde's Foundation?
Yeah, like Hyde's. And within the foundation world, you know, these are kind of well-known entities. And Benton, I think they were picked in particular because they have had a focus on communications and media, not on health. You can go to their website. Actually, Sound Partners has its own website, and you can look that up. All right, I'm going to say one more thing, and then we can have questions. I can turn it over to Scott and David. I wanted to give you websites for beginning research.
Do you have a website for the Robert Wood Johnson thing?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a website for the Robert Wood Johnson?
I don't know what their website is. I'm sure if you
Google
search under Robert Wood Johnson, it'll come
sure.
up immediately.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, they do have a website. I just can't tell you if it's, you know, RWJ or, you know, whatever. It's there. It's right there. And Sound Partners itself has a website, which has a lot of these case studies and, you know, descriptions of on it. And you read the stuff and you kind of say, like, well, of course, this is what community radio should be doing. I mean, it's actually very inspiring. You really get a lot of ideas from it. So the first website, Chronicle of Philanthropy, hard copy and online. I can't tell you how valuable this is. It tells you who's funding what. I don't mean just media. It it covers media funding, but it also tells you what other issues are hot in the funding world. It has controversies, so you know who's fighting with who. That's really useful to know. It has extraordinary things like, you know, when the United Way gets sued because their guy is, you know, gone off to Mexico and it's, you know, with the funds. It's got all that stuff in there. It's really juicy. It's like, you know, the National Enquirer of, you know, like social service stuff. I love reading the Chronicle. It's really hot. Anyway, they have a great publication. It comes out every 2 weeks. They have a really good website. They also have tons of jobs. If you decide you want to go to work in any area relating to development up and down the line, or communications, they always are advertising communications people. You can find stuff there. But the good thing to read it about is really to keep track of what is getting funded. It will give you ideas about what is getting funded. There are very often quirky places you can get money, and you'll look in the Chronicle and there'll be something, you'll go, gee, you can get money from them for this, and bing, you know, you're all set. So do take a look at that. In conjunction with that, you can look at the Foundation Center website. The Foundation Center website is good for locating foundations. It's not particularly good for doing research on how to fund your project, because if you look under media, it won't come up with a lot of stuff. You can't think about what you're doing as media. You have to think about it from the direction of what is the message and the issues that you're dealing with. If you look under media, you won't come up with much. But the Foundation Center lists every foundation that's in the Council Foundations and has all their websites linked. And it's a terrific resource for that. And you can get everything you need to start there. The third is one that was actually mentioned at one of the other workshops I was at, and I'm surprised the guy didn't say more about it. It's called GuideStar, GUIDESTAR. I think it's a .org. GuideStar is this fabulous website that has every 990 of every nonprofit and foundation in the country. This is where you're going to want to start looking for some other kinds of information. And you can check it out. You can look up your own radio station or your own partner group or anybody you want to check out, you know, the local United Way down the road, this private foundation. GuideStar is putting all of that stuff online, the 990s. And it's a terrific place to root around to see who might be giving money for stuff, but also what is more in detail, in depth of some of the stuff people are actually supporting, or if you want to do research, some name pops up as a funder or as a board member or something, you want to see where else they might show up, you can go to GuideStar. It's really, it's becoming really quite a wonderful place. So, let's see. Oh, I'm going to just, one more place to ask for money. Those are all institutional things that I've been talking about. Don't forget, you can ask individuals for money for your production, for your programs, for your station. I'm not talking about membership stuff. I think there was a whole other workshop on membership issues, events, that kind of thing, station activities. Individual solicitation. There are things you can do. The first thing you can do is you can do a mailing to your friends and ask for support. I know a lot of producers that have done that, and people send them money. You don't have to be a 501c3. People write the checks. You ask, you get your mailing list together of your friends and relatives, and you ask some of your friends to help you. You write a good, nice, friendly letter that says, I'm asking for your help, and here's what I want. And the checks will come in. It may not raise all the money you need, but it will raise some money, and it immediately gives you relationships with all these people who now have an interest in you, and will start to build from that. I know a lot of people who have done that, particularly for special projects. You know, I have the opportunity to go to the Durban conference and do a special report on, race in the UN. And if you could help me raise $2,500, it'll pay my airfare and I can stay there for a week, that kind of thing. It really works. People will be happy to send you some money. The next thing is special ask. You can make a special ask to someone. Here's an opportunity that is really important. It's usually a special ask like that is sort of a one-time thing. I'm not coming to ask you to support me over and over, but this is really, you know, will you be willing to give me some money for this one special thing? you can get a lot of money that way, even from people who may not even care what you're doing, but they appreciate the fact that you're doing it, and they'll write you a check once. That's a good way for things where it's appropriate. Usually it's for an extraordinary need, but, you know, and that also really works for stations, you know. You've got something really, an opportunity really special that's come up, and you're asking people for a special ask. We're not going to bother you, but this is really an opportunity we have to ask. For stations, for membership, you can ask for extra gifts. You've got your membership money in hand. They've just subscribed at $35 or $50. You want to ask them to make a next, you know, can you contribute an extra $15? If you can, it means we'll have this extra pool of money to do this special project with this partner group. That can also be very successful because it's a little bit increment more. You already have people who are already writing checks or contributing. The last thing is to do individual requests to individuals. You know, I mean, you can send a mailing out to your friends and they all get the same letter, but when you can meet with someone individually or write them a personal letter, it means a lot more. Here's where the relationship comes in, you know, and you can say, I've known you a long time, you know I'm involved in this project, I want to ask you for something really important to me. And I know you, Charlie, are interested in some of this stuff, and I'd like to ask you for, and usually that's for a little bit more money. That's not, that wouldn't be like for $25 or $50, it might be for more. But if it's personal, again, that relationship, you know, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You ask them for $500 and they send you a $100 check, you know? So think about that. You can certainly ask individuals. You don't have to be a 501c3 at all. And you will be surprised how much people appreciate your acknowledging that they want to help. You shouldn't think that people get annoyed when you ask them for money. I mean, some people will. Some people are honored that you are asking them for money. I'm serious.
Can I just say something? The president of our board, you know, this project, we just got our construction permit.
This is, tell me who you are and what board
you're
talking about.
Fort Collins, Colorado, public radio for the Front Range.
Oh, yes.
And we just got the 3,000 watt station.
Right.
But when our board president, who I don't remember if he was the president then, but he and his wife have been on the board since the beginning. 6 years ago, they got formally married, and they asked everyone to give to the radio station for wedding gifts.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's
a lot of money.
Yes, that's also, that's a really good thing.
Cool.
Special gifts. Mm-hmm. I actually did that myself. At my 50th birthday party, I asked everyone to give money to this particular group, and they got a lot of checks. I was very happy.
How many times can you do that, though?
Well,
it's a force to wear it again.
Anyway, these are actually very excellent ideas. And, you know, in light of that, I mean, you don't have to be married or have a birthday. I mean, you could have a party that was an event for your, you know, and that also you said you're doing this for this special thing and you want the contribution to go to the project, you know. I mean, these are more like, I don't want to get more into like event kinds of things, but, you know, people will be generous. People will respond if they think you really care about them and you're not just doing it sort of by rote. And once they give to you once, it's a lot easier to ask them to give to you again. And that's the same with foundations. You can go back to them again. You gave me money before, we did great. Here, I'm asking for more. A lot of foundations, it's not always one-time funding. A lot of times you can go back, and maybe they won't fund this project anymore, but you've got another really fabulous thing. And they like what you did before, and they're happy to continue to support things there. So it's really just a question of that very first ask. And, you know, like I said, the worst thing that happens is they say no, and then you go back and ask again, and then they say yes. Does anyone here know who Kim Klein is? Kim Klein puts out a very wonderful magazine called Grassroots Fundraising Journal. I recommend it highly.
She was the keynote speaker at one of the Grassroots Radio conferences.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Kim, her advice and the things she focuses on are primarily for organizational support. They're not for individuals. But some of the things she talks about certainly apply. I mean, individuals can use them as well. And she starts out by saying, you know, the 50% of the time when you ask people, they say no. What does that mean?
50%
of the time they say yes. And once you have that first check that someone that you ask someone you get, then you're all ready to go ask a lot more people. So it helps for you to realize that you don't have to be afraid to do it, and just you can keep asking for these things, and they will people will support you. But the partnerships and the relationships are really important, and your demo tapes, demo CDs, whatever format you're using. I'm going to stop there. I don't know if people want to ask me questions or if you guys want to talk right after that.
Maybe we should take a few questions and then we'll try to be very brief.
Okay. Yes.
How useful is something like a donors forum or one of these places where you go and actually look up grant type information? I've been to one once, didn't find it too useful, but I thought maybe there could be some use there. I was wondering if you had any experience with that. And I certainly did like the Linton Foundation newsletter. We use that in a news program we put together.
Yeah.
A lot of their stuff is good.
The donor forums, it's actually a good question about some of that. I would say that in terms of free research, I'd say as long as you don't have to pay a lot for it, it's probably worth checking out.
What is a donor's forum?
Well, I wasn't sure what this, but I mean like a place for their funders or like, are you talking about an online website?
Well, this one, actually, the one I'm familiar with is in Chicago, and they're at actual physical location, and you go down there and they've got...
Oh, you mean like a foundation center?
File cabinets,
yeah.
Full of information on donors and...
The foundation center. This is the foundation center. This I mentioned they have an online site. You can do a lot of that research online. There is a physical foundation center in New York. You can go down there and it's like a library. It's open to anyone. You can walk in and do research. You can do research with them only up to a point. If you want more really in-depth things, you have to pay a fee or subscribe to some of their services. I would say for most of you, the size of your organizations or you as individuals is probably not worth the investment at level two. But at level one, to go in for free or for $25 or something like that, that's probably worth it. There is a lot of information for free that's available on the site. There is also a state organization here in New York called the New York... this is bad. It's the New York network of grant makers. And it's a group of New York state funders. And they also have information. Most of it is information that goes to the funders. It's not information that goes from funders to grantees. But there is some information in there about what the funders are kind of thinking about. And sometimes they hold public forums and things like that in different places. There probably are state organizations like that in a lot of states, not necessarily every place. So other hands, questions, comments, things? Yeah.
I was told by another grant writing workshop that when you get a rejection, it's really good to get back to them right away and
yes.
Say, thank you for considering my application. What could I do to change it next time? Like,
yes.
Actually get their advice, and sometimes they'll spell it out to you and say, this is exactly what we want. It's almost a fit, and this is why it isn't. Try again. And
absolutely.
Really
that's why I said, don't take no for an answer. Build that relationship. Call them up on the phone. I'll give you an example, actually, of something that just happened. There's a group. It's not a radio group, but there's a group that I work with in New York City that the Tides Foundation, which is also a kind of community-type fund, they were giving out some earmarked funds around organizing after 9/11. This particular group was eligible, but they didn't know about it because they weren't doing their homework. And they didn't find out about it until after the deadline. And I said to them, we should find out if there's anything else going on because this group is really eligible. And then I found out that they were giving a second round of grants. It was only going to the group that was included in the first solicitation. And this organization wasn't included because they had been left out. And I said, call them up and, talk to them. So, they called them up and they said, we were left out of the first one, but we think we're really eligible and we want to apply in this round. And they said, fine. So they was like, you mean yes? I said, yeah, that's the whole point. And they said, yes. You can always, sometimes the foundations, you can't talk to them, but a lot of times they will. And they will tell you why you were rejected. And as soon as you actually have a real person and start having a conversation with them, it doesn't even matter what they tell you. I mean, it does matter some, but it's where the relationship comes in. And then you say, well, I want to make sure the next round we know what's going on. Sometimes they'll say, let us know before you send in your formal application. We'll look it over, or we'll tell you what it is, or we'll tell you if we really can't do it. But as soon as you have that relationship, it changes your ability to deal with that institution in terms of asking them for money. As much as possible, you should really not be afraid to call up and talk to these people on the phone, or show up at a place where they're having a meeting, or, you know, a social event or anything like that. Because that really, in some ways, a lot of things, the real difference is if they know who you are. Because they can get six things that all say the same thing, they're going to go for the one that they know. Like I said, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are on your applications. But that actually, if you don't mind, I'm going to give you a little bit of advice specifically about grant writing, unless you don't want to hear it. It's short. I have four bullet points about actually when you write your proposal, when you write your solicitation letter, whenever you're writing anything, it doesn't matter who you're sending it to. The first thing is to write clearly and plainly. Don't use long sentences. Short sentences. One thought per sentence. You may be talking about something complicated. Break it down. And try and be as concrete as possible. Describe what you really have in mind. And if you need help, have someone who doesn't know what you're talking about read it, and they'll tell you if they understand it. It's really a good gauge. If they understand it, you're doing good. If they don't understand it, you better rewrite it. Because you should assume that whoever is reading your stuff doesn't know anything about it. And you have to explain it to them. So you want to make it clear, and you want to make it simple as you can, and you want to be concrete so you can make sure they do understand what you are trying to say. And I know some of that is stylistic, but some of it is also just how you conceive of what you're doing. People who read a lot of proposals and a lot of fundraising letters, you know, you can get through the rhetoric pretty easily, and you know whether there's anything substantive there. Give them the substance. Forget about the flowery stuff. They don't need it. Go right to the jugular. Here's what we want to do, and here's why it's a good idea. Make it easy for the reader to follow your thinking, particularly with foundations. Any of these funding agencies that are institutions or agencies, they read millions of these things. Do not make them work. If they have to work to read it, you've lost them. They won't pay attention if they have to really work for what you're saying. What do these guys really want? You've lost them. Say what you want. Put the ask right up front. If you can't summarize what you're doing in three sentences, you're already lost. But try and make it easy for them to follow what you're saying. And I'll tell you my own personal rule of thumb in terms of style. Very often, you know, they'll give you, you'll have a format, you know, who we are, and, you know, here's what we're going to do, and here's the needs statement, etc. Put that stuff in bold, and don't just say needs statement. Say the need. We need better information about AIDS. Put that in the paragraph title in bold. My personal rule of thumb is that a reader should be able to read the headings, the bold headings in the proposal, and get the whole proposal. That means they probably only have to read six or seven sentences. The rest of it is explanation. But if they read those six or seven bold things, and it actually says what's in each paragraph, they'll get it. And I'll be happy to either read proposals or give you examples of some of these proposals. I'll give you short ones, you know, two or three pages, just to see what it means. It makes a huge difference. If you make stuff easy for these folks to read, man, they'll love you. I'm not kidding. They will love you. And the last thing, and this is really important, for those people that have directions on how to fill out their forms, follow the directions. They will not consider your application if you don't do what they have asked you to do. I'm serious. It may sound weird, but if they say, fit your thing in this space, and it has to be 12-point type, don't put it on two pages in 10-point type. They'll throw it out. You're making them work. There's a reason that they've done it. You have no idea who's going to read this stuff. you have no idea who they're going to show it to. And if they told you to do it in a certain way, no matter how stupid it sounds, do it that way. Don't say, see attached. That is not the way to win their heart. The way to win their heart is to follow their directions. And if you have any questions, call them or email them and ask them, what should I do? I don't understand this. They will give you the answer. And you already, even if you've called up, you've already made a contact with someone there by talking to someone on the phone or even sending an email. And you can even make up a question, even if you know the answer. I just want to check with you. Is this correct? That way you've already had something. They're going to say, oh, yeah, I remember you sent something to us already. Or you called up, I just want to make sure what you mean is this. I mean, I'll tell you kind of a stupid example of this. I am working with a group in New York to put together a big proposal for the Department of Education to fund a community technology center. These are big proposals, you know. And it's really federal legalese, really dense, and you have to really carefully. And this particular proposal, the request for proposals was poorly organized, so it was very hard to even follow what they wanted. We had to really dissect it. It was a matching grant program. We didn't know, we couldn't figure out what the match was. Can you believe that? The language was extremely confusing. And it took us 4 calls to someone, to find someone in that program at the Commerce Department to tell us what the right answer was. But now that person knows who we are. We got the right answer. And when our proposal comes through the door, they're going to be looking for it. Now that was a bad example because it was a stupid thing. We shouldn't have even had to call about it. But that's the kind of thing. Even if you can make up an excuse to contact them, like I said, you know, you may already know the answer, but you just want to call them up and say, I just want to make sure, you know, this is right, or I had a question about this, you know, to give them an impression of who you are. But follow the directions. Really follow the directions. They're there for a reason, even if they're stupid reasons. If you do all those things, you'll at least have good proposals, and that helps. I also had the experience where I wrote a proposal for a group, and we sent it into a foundation, and they didn't fund it. And it wasn't because the group didn't have, they actually had a relationship, et cetera, et cetera. This is kind of a new thing. This funder hadn't really funded this kind of thing before. It was slightly different from what their thing was, but it was close enough that the funder was ready to, the group wanted to go in and sort of lay it in front of them. They didn't fund the proposal, but then they called the group up and said, we love the way your proposal was written. Can we use this as a model? And I said, you tell those guys to write you a check first. Serious. They can't use this for a model unless they're going to pay you. You know, if they love it so much, why aren't they supporting it? But they liked the proposal format, and this was a really complicated thing. It took me 4 rewrites, and I usually only need 2. Because I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure out how to write it properly. But the 4th one, that was the one they loved. So anyway, but it was, you know, clear language. And I think part of it was because I actually had these headings where you could follow, you know, the headings were actually in the argument was actually the headings. And that was like, oh, okay. So instead of just like who we are, it was like who we are, the brilliant coalition of blah, blah. Yeah. All right, other comments, questions? Nobody, I mean, if you've got grant proposals, I'll be happy to read them. But I'm available to assist in anything you want. I can answer questions. I can read through stuff if you want. I know about some of these specific programs, and I also know a lot about private foundation funding.
Will you be available through the weekend? People can talk to you.
Yeah, I'll be here through Sunday, and I'm looking for a ride back to New York on Sunday if anyone has room in their car.
Go ahead. Scott and I just want to make couple of comments. But go ahead.
Okay, if you have a question, then that's going to take the floor.
Earlier in the discussion, you mentioned that in some cases you didn't have to be a 501c. I'm trying to refresh my memory. Those are the cases of what, private foundations?
No. Well, some private foundations, some NEA foundations, some arts things, some sub-programs will give money to individuals. But, there's no rule of thumb about that. You have to read it. But there are definitely programs that will give money to individuals. And you do not need a 501c3. If you need a 501c3, obviously you should have someone lined up that can act as your fiscal sponsor.
Right.
How about your email address, Nan?
My email address is real easy. Okay. It's my name, one word.
All right.
N-A-N-R-U-B-I-N, one word, at AOL. You could also go to my website and get me there. And my website is my name, www.nanrubin.com.
Great. In a little over an hour, that was very comprehensive.
It was.
Go get that cat. How is that, honey?
She must be a New Yorker because she speaks so quickly.
No, I had lots of smushing.
I think this is going to be an interesting transition, and Scott and I are going to make a basic proposal that is somewhat in an experimental stage, but we have an idea. We have ideas for other ways of approaching this. We're not going to have very much time to lay this out. So when this is when the official workshop is over at 5:15, we're going to have a breakout session in this room to set up a working group to fully flesh out hopefully and discuss in further detail this idea that we have.
One idea.
Well, that's what I'm going to describe now. This model, and she told you pretty much all the basics that you need to know about the competitive grant, going after grants model that has been the model that radio and TV and other media producers have used for decades. I can speak from personal experience and from talking to other people that in some cases it just doesn't work. It's not sustaining us as producers of cultural material, you know, social and political and cultural fare. So we're trying to think of ways of non-competitive models, ways of sustaining us. And there are historical precedents for this. And I'm not naive. I don't think we're naive to believe that we're going to bring back the WPA, or go back to the whatever it was, the 15th century, the Borgias that gave money to artists. But the model is about sustaining the person, the worker, rather than going from applying for grants project to project to project. Some projects will get funded, some won't. This is more of an idea of how do we sustain the person so that they can do this type of work on an ongoing basis without having to worry about filling in with, I do a lot of temp work, day jobs, and it's very difficult to have a day job and try to think about writing grants and going out and doing interviews and producing what we hope will be compelling radio. But also I have two small children and worrying about supporting my family, and some producers are very successful at this. And there are ways to be successful at this, as Nan pointed out. We're hoping that we can present and find sort of a critical mass for some other ways of doing this. And one of the ideas that I've thought about is creating some kind of fund, and you could call it an endowment or a trust fund. Somewhat in the same way universities raise money to carry them through the good economic times and the bad economic times, an endowment fund that a group, as large as possible, a group of radio producers can share. So they have financing, they have money, they have salaries, if you will, to support them. There is some models in existence now that approach this in some ways. We've heard about the video, the ITVS model, where this group of independent video producers convinced Congress to give them some millions of dollars per year in funding. The challenge is that they've become another bureaucracy with a bunch of gatekeepers, and it's somewhat competitive in that sense also. So, but maybe we need some organization, some collaboration, some consortium of independent radio producers that's somewhat like what the independent video video people did. And there's a number of organizations that would work with us on this. Maybe you want to address some of the organizations.
Yeah. Well, just to give you some background for work that I do with Between the Lines, we have a group now for 10 years that produces this weekly radio news magazine that we send out to other stations around the country. And all of us are volunteers and have been, and as you are, probably many of the people here at this conference are not paid staff, but they're volunteers, and they do it out of a passion for radio. And I don't think many of us came in to community radio thinking it was going to be our job. We sort of had this view that, you know, part of my life was going to be radio, and part of my life was going to be going out to make money to pay the rent. And there are certainly some individuals around the country, as David said, that have made the breakthrough and gotten grants to do their love, to do their passion. But not all of us can do that. And one of the obstacles I think I've seen over the years is that if you're doing politically charged work, you know, from the left perspective, very often the big foundations, the corporate foundations, are not going to be very happy about funding someone who's attacking them. There are exceptions, but this idea of a cooperative model of maybe producers getting together to seek funds for various, you know, news, arts, documentary projects in radio is something that I think to some degree other organizations have done. I'm not sure the idea has been sort of tossed out at a GRC meeting and some, you know, brainstorming has gone on to see if together as a group, you know, 100, 300, 500 independent producers from across the country, including, you know, people from indie media, of course, there's a whole new rush of new young people coming into this thing, that if together we can make some proposals to, you know, thematically, topics, areas, issues, that we can together make some pitch to some foundations. And there has been a lot of, I think, some problems with foundations in terms of, again, from a progressive or left perspective, that a lot of foundations who we would think would be on our side are not willing to fund media in a big way, or at least not you know, community radio media in a big way, so that, you know, the field is left to the big networks, the cable stations, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, and NPR. And just one other point about sort of career trajectories. I think a lot of people in community radio, they look at, you know, the choices in front of them, and, you know, maybe you started a college or a community station, and in terms of supporting a family, maybe one of the few choices you would have that's sustainable is to say, well, I'm going to sort of retool, reshape the way I do radio, maybe, you know, from an idealistic point of view. I'm going to reshape that and change it, make it over, so that I can fit into the NPR model of broadcasting. And that's not to say that NPR is somehow anathema or not good. They do some excellent programming, as we all know, but they don't do what we do. And I think this idea is to sort of like put our heads together to see, is there some better way or additional way besides all individually going out after these grants where we could pool our brains and our minds and our vision to see if we could approach some funders together to you know, run the gamut of anything. But I would just say, you know, there are, as I'm sure Nan can tell you better than I, NFCB supports the individual producers with workshops, and I think there's some new mentoring programs that are set up through AIR and some other groups that are able to do that. And you also have the IMCs, of course, which are starting to write grants. But I think we wanted to sort of bring this to another level and to get more concrete about how we can get together and take another step forward. And it's, the idea is not, you know, certainly fully fleshed out yet. So we're really looking for input and ideas and some brainstorming after the session is over to see if you'd be interested in that.
The basic premise is the idea that we're more powerful as a group rather than as individuals all competing for the same small pool of money. And so two immediate concrete ways of thinking about this would be, one would be to apply for grants as larger groups rather than individuals. And another way to look at this, and I know we're not educated, once we leave our childhood, we're not educated in terms of, we don't believe in terms of sharing, even though we tell our kids that they should share. When we become adults, we stop sharing in a lot of different ways. But one model might be that if you get a grant, to a percentage of that grant should go to this, as I call it, an endowment fund to help all of us as a group. Because we're not all working on the same projects and in the same parts of the country, but we're all part of this grassroots community, independent, non-commercial radio community, for lack of a better word.
And just one other thing that this, when you're listening to a talk, you might think, well, this is all about foundations and grants, but there are other things that we can do together, and there are a lot of great models out there for it. So if independent producers get together, we can find maybe better ways to distribute our work. And we could also make it sustainable. You know, maybe there are CD packages of the best of community radio from around the country that listeners around the country would want, or MP3 downloads that people would want to subscribe to on a weekly basis. That could be a source of revenue for all of us. And, you know, with the internet, of course, it opens up a lot of new avenues and ideas for thinking about how, again, we could pool our resources to dream up sustainable ways so we can do projects beyond. You know, I'm just thinking, when I do radio and when you do radio, it may be, you know, after work till 3 in the morning, you get up the next day and you're dragging. And that's the way, you know, I think a lot of people in community radio operate. But I think the vision of making it more sustainable could also sort of push the horizons of what we're able to accomplish further ahead. You know, 3 hours at midnight isn't maybe the optimal time to do the projects you want to do. So it's all part of the funding. Individual grants is certainly one thing that's worked for many, many people. But I think we're trying to think of something new or reinvent something somebody else has done.
Right. Yeah, I got two questions for you guys. And the first one is, why aren't you talking about this being part of AIR?
Oh, I have AIR super highlighted in my notes. And that
AIR is a national organization of independent producers.
Right. I'm familiar with AIR having been a member, and I spoke to Dolores Brandon for about an hour recently, and they are definitely thinking about this. For those who may or may not know, the Association of Independent Producers
right?
primarily do lobbying on behalf of independent producers, so their main, in the past, raison d'etre has been to renegotiate rates for producers whose feed material to NPR and PRI. That's been one of their main foci. But Dolores Brandon says they are definitely interested, in her words, developing an independent fund that's managed by a consortium of producers. So they are looking at a similar sort of thing. And we have a whole list of organizations that could possibly collaborate with us, one of which may be Pacifica, and Scott spoke to Leslie Kagan. You know, as Pacifica gets out of debt, hopefully, and rises up out of the ashes, they might be interested, as they pull the affiliates back and the independent producers back into their fold, of collaborating on something like this, a more sustainable, ongoing funding mechanism. AIR, definitely. Possibly NFCB, possibly the Media Alliance in San Francisco, and a group at Boston College called the Media Research and Activist Project. So, yeah, we're not discounting any of these groups.
Yeah, I think that was a primary thing in the discussion we had about this idea, and again, this is not fully formed, but wanting just to spark more discussion, is that we don't want to invent a new bureaucracy. We don't want to invent a new group with, you know, administrative overhead. We'd like to fold this idea and, you know, get a group of people to fold in with AIR or Pacifica, and maybe bring to them some new ways that we can collaborate together that, you know, maybe they're not pursuing right now. So that was certainly something that we had in mind.
Did you have a second question?
I had a second question.
Uh-oh.
you're talking about an endowment. I don't know what you're talking about in terms of dollars, but where was this money to populate the endowment going to come from?
Well, there are ideas. One would be to ask producers to share a small percentage of their grants, what that would one way or another. I've got a list of ideas that we can talk about in the breakout session that seem to be unique ways of raising money on the local level, and some of which involve applying for grants, but other sorts of ideas that involve the public a little more. the paying public that's seeking out entertainment, and having some of that money poured. Yeah. So at this point I couldn't give you a dollar amount, but we're not talking about supplying large salaries for hundreds of people, maybe sometime in the future, possibly, but at least sustaining people between from project to project as a starting point, or from grant to grant.
And how would these individuals be eligible?
That's a great question, and something that, you know, we've thought about. And I would rather have as small a gate as possible. And I would rather take the chance that there might be some people who might exploit it if it meant we could fund as many legitimate people as possible. I'm not yet concerned that we're going to be exploited out of business.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant, like, particularly if you're going to start with a limited pool of money, you're going to have a lot of people asking for it.
Yeah, how do you choose who gets it and who doesn't? It's a competitive process.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that sense, yes. There is going to be some competition. It's not going to be completely egalitarian in that sense.
And you're talking about sustaining someone from project to project, but it sounds like it means you're going to get some money and you can count on that coming in, like as a stipend or something, and how are there going to be new people coming in? And I mean, it just sounds like it would take some real thoughtfulness to structure in a way that reflects what you want to do.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And we welcome not only suggestions, but criticism and a hard look at whether or not this idea is practical and pragmatic. We want to be challenged because we think we have the core of a good idea, and we want it to be polished.
I just wanted to ask something. I guess when I was listening to Nan's talk, and I'm sort of knowing that there's also a need for sort of an independent producers consortium, I mean, I saw elements in her discussion when she was talking about groups coalitioning on a local level. I mean, I could see sort of like a larger consortium having collective coalitions within, dealing with certain issues that go at you. Within the consortium, certain groups that producers that are working on for grants on based on certain issues. I mean, there's a way to work collectively. Like you're just talking about, it was easy to get local grants that way. But if you got lots of different groups throughout the country, you work on eventually going for those larger grants, national grants. And, there should be some sort of national. Way a cooperative model, or per se, more of a cooperative model in a consortium. We have more pool of resources, we can work with to network with on topics, rather than there's an individually. It's hard to find producers and funders in your area. And, once you sort of coordinated a little bit more. You can get more synergy going in terms of the larger funding for all these other elements you're talking about, for more sustainability, more long range. So I saw benefits to sort of both models that you're
talking
about. Oh, absolutely.
I think they're compatible.
Yeah.
It's going through my head on one level here. From what little I understand about grants, the idea of everybody siphoning off a little bit from their grants. As I understand it, a grant is given for a specific mission and project in mind. I'm not sure how the source of the grants, if they'd be happy about a portion, I've got the wrong idea, where the source of those grants are coming from, would be happy that a portion of that grant is siphoned off for a completely different reason than the grant was originally given.
Well,
that's
a very valid question. In my mind, the precedent is the percentage you give to your funding agent, your fiscal agent. Your fiscal sponsor. So, for instance, most of these foundations that give money, allow you to put in my case, my fiscal agent, I have a deal, 5%. We can't do this in the dark. We have to involve funders in this process and say we'd like to take a 0.5% or 1%, and create of as many of these grants as possible and create this new fund or this new consortium. But we have to do it with their support and their blessing.
Well, don't ask for their blessing. You don't want
their support.
You want their money. You don't want their blessing. Mm-hmm. The answer to that is, in some instances, it would be okay, and in others, it wouldn't. In some instances, I mean, it depends on how the grant is structured, what it's for, and how much is allowable for overhead and operating. I mean, you could always take some money and not tell them what you're doing. You know, you could just put it in. No.
But that would be wrong.
No.
I will say
Nancy. No. I don't mean tell them. I don't mean tell them. I mean, you don't put it in your line item budget as, you know, 1% for the producer's fund.
Right.
You know, you put it in your overhead and operating. Instead of having it be 5% for your fiscal sponsor, you have 6% for your fiscal sponsor, that kind of thing. But that's not always allowed. And depending upon what this might actually look like, I mean, you've got some fiscal sponsors that want 10 or 15%. You add a couple more on top of that. Pretty soon you don't have any money going into the project. Or you have to really think about what makes sense. For these small grants in particular, you can never take a very high amount for them.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
No.
I mean, I think certainly philosophically that we need to get over that hump, which is the way to do it is to always be in competitions. And on the other side of the mountain is a valley there where we're sharing as a way of benefiting the whole group. I didn't say that very articulately, but I think you understand what I mean.
David, if you don't mind, the example you were giving about ITVS, the Independent Television Service, is actually not comparable to what you're talking about.
Not entirely, sure.
It's not a cooperative model. It's not a model for sustaining projects in that fashion. It is competitive grant money. It is a congressional allocation, and it came about in part because the money was taken away from CPB. That was good. CPB didn't like it, but CPB was not giving money to independent producers, and so Congress said, if you're not going to do it, we will do it ourselves. So it's actually a very different kind of a thing because that took a whole lobbying effort, etc.
Well, thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah.
So we're gonna be, Scott and I will be here from 5:15 on to talk more about this.
Thank you.
Good luck. I
just think to come up with a model, I just think doing it with the membership of AIR just makes a whole lot of sense because people will really have a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, that and Transom are the two places to go. Because it's already a big collection of producers and discussions.
I think a lot of community stations contributing to Transom. I explored the site.
It's mostly independent.
Yeah.
It's not station based.
But there mostly things coming on as NPR versus community stations.
So what do you mean?
Transom?
None of it's going to
be. None of it.
It's all stuff they can't get on, or people don't work. It's new producers, they don't have any place to go. It was set up specifically to give producers a place to go.
It's a distribution network.
Yeah. And a place to exchange ideas.
That's Jay Allison. That's Jay Allison.
Yeah.
That and the radio exchange. Yeah. That's kind of, they just hired the executive director.
That's $75,000 a year.
You see, there you go. There's one of the issues is that managers in certain situations make way too much money.
Yeah.
As compared to everybody else.
I had a comment.
Sure.
I would think that basically, essentially, what you're giving is union models in terms of association.
Yes.
And in addition, obviously, you should be able to, in effect, pay, in effect, what you might call dues, regardless of what you get, as far as grants. In other words, if you get a grant and you feel this organization has helped you get that grant, then obviously you should have a responsibility to support that organization. And if that is your organization, that would be a good way to deal with it. You don't really have to look and say, well, a percentage of my grant is going for this. I mean, theoretically it should, but obviously, again, you get into a sticky issue of whether the grants or the grantees will tolerate that kind of thing. But obviously, if you provide a service that's good enough that people are thanking you for what you're doing, then obviously they're going to be willing to support what you're doing. So, you know, the idea is essentially very good.
But putting it into practice is going to be very challenging.
Yes. I agree. I certainly like the idea that you're not too worried about the large amounts of money, but you're more interested in just getting the thing sustained.
You're going to have a lot less money. You're going to be able to fund you. They won't be interested in funding you. You know, so you have to really structure yourself differently if you're going to go for any money that would be eligible for nonprofit. They can't give it to you if you're a profit.
But if you have a fiscal sponsor.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, because a fiscal sponsor can't give it to you as a for-profit group. Mm-hmm. Why? That's restricted.
All right, so I guess the bottom line of this question that I keep asking is, what should we restructure ourselves as a nonprofit?
Well, you can restructure yourself, or you can set up a parallel thing that does similar things, but it's a nonprofit organization. I mean, that's a lot of people do. I mean, usually it's the nonprofit organization that sets up a parallel for-profit. You can do it the other way around. That would be
eligible. I'm actually hoping.
But you should be very careful about the relationship between the organizations.
Oh, and
we're going to get a lot of money for nonprofits.
Pretty much all have.